I want to begin this morning with another poem, this time by a poet named Clint Smith. He's a young poet who describes himself as writer, teacher, researcher. He's the winner of the 2017 Literary Award for Best Poetry, excuse me, from the Black Caucus of the American Library Association, and a finalist for an NAACP Image Award for his book, Counting Dissent. He's a rising voice. The title of his poem is When People Say We Have Made It Through Worse Before. It's kind of a long title for a poem, but it makes me wonder if he is referencing the Reverend William Barber, who is the leader of the Contemporary Poor People's Campaign, who not infrequently suggests that very thing, which is true that we have made it through worse before. If we think of things like the Civil War and two world wars of the century just past, and Korea and Vietnam, and not just these kinds of wars, but Jim Crow, and civil rights and women's rights, and Roe versus Wade, and the fight for the rights of our LGBTQ siblings, and immigration rights, it is true we have made it through worse before. And when people say we have made it through worse before, all I hear is the wind slapping against the gravestones of those who did not make it, those who did not survive to see the confetti fall from the sky, those who did not live to watch the parade roll down the street. I have grown accustomed to a lifetime of aphorisms meant to assuage my fears, pithy sayings meant to convey that everything ends up fine in the end. There is no solace in rearranging language to make a different word tell the same lie. Sometimes the moral arc of the universe does not bend in a direction that will comfort us. Sometimes it bends in ways we don't expect, and there are people who fall off in the process. Please, dear reader, do not say I am hopeless. I believe there is a better future to fight for. I simply accept the possibility that I may not live to see it. I have grown weary of telling myself lies that I might one day begin to believe. We are not all left standing after the war has ended. Some of us have become ghosts by the time the dust has settled. It is heartbreaking, this message, that regardless the war, some of us have become ghosts by the time the dust has settled, victims perhaps, both literal and metaphorical, of the very struggles meant to liberate us. This weekend, and tomorrow in particular, are the days set aside specifically to remember those who have fought and died in wars, died fighting actual wars on actual battlefields like Flanders Fields. In this country, we have been making the time, ostensibly, to honor them, the men and women who no doubt hoped they would return and did not. We have been doing this since shortly after the Civil War. This Day of Memory was officially proclaimed on May 5th in 1868 by General John Logan, who was the then national commander of the Grand Army of the Republic, in his General Order No. 11. The 30th of May, 1868, is designated for the purpose of strewing with flowers or otherwise decorating the graves of comrades who died in defense of their country during the late rebellion, and whose bodies now lie in almost every city, village, and hamlet churchyard in the land. He proclaimed the date of Decoration Day, as he called it, was chosen because it wasn't the anniversary of any particular battle. All these many years later, we who yearn for peace, who hope that one day and sooner than later, all swords will be turned to plowshares and that we will study war no more, we struggle to make sense of why humans keep turning to violence to resolve conflict. We may even feel conflicted ourselves about honoring those who fought when we don't think fighting is the answer to begin with. And after all, why can't we do better? And here is the temptation: to turn away from the whole thing, to set ourselves apart from those who haven't figured out that war is not the answer, to refuse to pick up the torch we were implored to hold high in John McCrae's haunting World War II poem. It is so tempting to withhold any participation in an observation like this weekend's, since we are committed to a different image of human interaction. We hear ourselves say that their lives were not lost after all. They did not choose to give, but their lives were taken, as though we know every possible choice. And also, it is all so terribly and tragically sad that we hardly know what to do with the waste of it all. When Rumi suggests, as he did in our opening words, that we be grateful for whoever comes because each visitor has been sent as a guide from beyond, he can't have met this kind of unexpected visitor, right? He can't have meant war and violence and killing. But in fact, I think he did. And we must recognize, in this odd and unintuitive way, to be grateful for the opportunity to struggle, to challenge, and be curious over and over until we get it right. To remember those who are gone so that we turn over every stone of discomfort and disillusion and frustration on behalf of those who can't, until we figure it out. We cannot allow ourselves to turn away from this reminder of our collective human failings, how we fail each other over and over, even as painful as it is. Because our eyes open to the tragedy of war is perhaps the best impetus to move us forward. There are so many things that I would rather not be curious about in this living, things that I would be more comfortable ignoring, war not least. But war is also not a standalone. There's inequality and injustice and inhumanity and bigotry, to name just a few. You likely can think of more, even as you might prefer not to. I imagine us saying to our friends, "Church was great today. We had to think about all the things we never want to have to think about." But who do we become if we despair of the curiosity required to face those realities? Because they are realities in our lives. On what righteous post do we stand alone when we refuse to question the uncomfortable truths? It's out there in the middle of the ocean somewhere, that post, when the rest of us are here in the middle and the mess. Does anyone remember the Lao Tzu poem about peace in the world? "If there is to be peace in the world," he wrote, "there must be peace in the nations. If there is to be peace in the nations, there must be peace in the cities. If there is to be peace in the cities, there must be peace between neighbors. If there is to be peace between neighbors, there must be peace in the home. If there is to be peace in the home, there must be peace in the heart." And that's a clue for us, perhaps. We know how hard it is to feel at peace in our hearts. No wonder peace in the world is so difficult. But yes, we must start here with peace in the heart. And I suppose we could hang out on our ocean outpost if that were enough. But we're not meant to be islands of serenity. We are relational beings in this life. That's why the reality of war and of inequality and of injustice, that's why they are all so painful. And we can't stop at peace in the heart and expect that it magically projects itself everywhere else. We have to work for this peace in the heart and peace in the home and peace between neighbors and in cities and between nations. It starts here. It can't stop here. It is our task to leave no stone unturned, else we and everyone else continue to be the victims of our lack of willingness. A number of us went to see a play last Sunday called The Return. It was put on by a group called Israeli Stage. The play was about a woman who returns to Israel to make amends to a Palestinian man who is her former lover, whom she had falsely accused. And it was an hour wrought with emotion and filled with the nuanced complexity and lack of resolution that is plaguing the Middle East even as we speak. This war is very much alive, in fact, and I was grateful. Actually, I found myself grateful to have the chance to confront these issues as they play out on a very human stage. Because I think when we stop being willing to do that, we can give up hope of ever finding the resolution. There is a plaque that's in the entryway now of our sanctuary that used to hang in the narthex with the names of 30 members of this congregation, 29 men and one woman, who served in the First World War, the war we so wish had ended all wars. I don't know if they died in service, but I want to offer their names this morning to you as the insistence of our staying curious about how we can be better and to work towards that end together. They sat here, they worshiped here, these people. Walter Baldwin, C. Gilman Davis, James Estabrook, Edmund Ferry, Carlyle Fisk, Newell Foster, Warren Freeman Jr., Manson Glover, F. Ernest Griffin, Roy Hall, D. Weld Harrington, Martin Heiligman Jr., William Heiligman, Lawrence Irving, Ralph Irving, Charles Koopman, Herbert Lindenberg, Lewis McCarthy, Arnold Morse, Harry Morse, Howard Morse, Nathan Morse, A. Otis Moulton, Emma Nichols, Nathaniel Nutting, Herbert Plimpton, Frank Sedgley, Harold Warner, Alfred Weston, N. Windsor Whittemore. May their names be reminders to us that we must not rest until we all find a better way. Spirit of life, give us courage to answer the cry of humanity's pain, and with our bare hands, out of full hearts, with all our intelligence, let us create the peace. May we leave no stone unturned, no matter how uncomfortable. Let us build those stones instead into cairns for the living, for all living, that someday we will find peace in all the nations. May it be so.